Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're talking with Peter Suderman. He's the features editor for Reason, and he's one of the country's sharpest analysts of the rambling wreck known as Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act. He's got a great new in-depth story up at Reason.com. It's called Democrats Defect from Obamacare. Meanwhile, the GOP learns to stop worrying and love Obama's signature legislative victory. Peter, thanks for joining the Reason Podcast.
Glad to be here.
All right. Well, let's get right to it. You start your piece by talking about Mark Dayton, the Democratic governor of Minnesota, complaining last fall on a Sunday Yak show that while Obamacare does have some good features, he actually said it was no longer affordable to increasing numbers of people. Why is that kind of public statement of discontent, particularly from a Democratic governor, why is that a big deal? And what does it kind of portend for the larger issues surrounding the sustainability and viability of Obamacare?
So I think it's important to remember the kind of context in which this remark was made in two ways. And one is that this came right as open enrollment for Obamacare was happening again. And so sort of in the run-up to seeing new rates and people picking new plans, because Obamacare has this open enrollment season every year where you get to pick your new plan and you get to see what the new rates are. And it's sort of it's all compressed into a few weeks or months at the end of the year. And then the other thing that was happening was the presidential election. And, you know, in the few weeks, months before the election, the widespread assumption was that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and that Democrats would perhaps even gain a majority in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And so what this remark kind of signaled was that Democrats might be shifting a little bit in terms of how they talked about Obamacare. Since the law was passed in March of 2010, Democrats have basically taken an entirely defensive stance on the law, every now and then saying, well, maybe there's some things that aren't quite perfect about it. But basically saying Republicans are trying to kill this thing and we need to stop that. And that's about as far as they went most of the time.
Right. And of course, in the fall, I guess it was, or late summer, early fall, Bill Clinton was quoted as saying that the Obamacare subsidy plan and all of this, that it was the craziest thing he'd ever seen. So there was... But you're right to suggest or you're underscoring the idea that this was all being said in the context of people assuming a Hillary Clinton win, and hence Democrats would be allowed to go back in and kind of tinker on the edges or kind of open up the engine and kind of fix Obamacare without having to worry about the GOP completely repealing it or gutting it or something like that.
So what you started to see, I think, given the assumption that Clinton was going to win and that Democrats would have some sort of influence in Congress, was a recognition that Obamacare isn't working for a lot of people, that the law as implemented and as written is not a complete success and that it needs meaningful changes. And that was... it wasn't a wholesale turnaround from Democrats, and it wasn't something that we had simply never heard once before, but there was a real shift happening, and they were gearing up to make some changes to the law. And even Hillary Clinton, when she would be asked about it in the debates, Clinton would basically say, well, I want to keep the parts that work and fix the rest. And she wouldn't go into the fixes for the most part. Sometimes she did in papers on her website, things like that. But as a general rule in sort of more public forum, she wouldn't really talk in great detail about the fixes she had in mind, wanting to leave herself some options. But her message was this: parts of the law need to be kept, but it needs also to be sort of updated and fixed to work better.
So
this was a preparation for making some of those changes. And of course, now things are very different with Donald Trump having won.
Beyond Mark Dayton, you know, and I think he's saying what a lot of people are saying is that when he said the law or the insurance coverage is becoming too expensive for a lot of people. You hear a lot of stories. You talk about there were a couple of states where premiums on the exchange went up by, you know, something like 60% and things like that. Healthcare providers, health insurance providers are pulling out of certain Obamacare exchanges. Beyond the price increases, what are other signs that the law is either unsustainable in its current form or really needs deep revisions on its own terms?
So the price increases are the place to start, and they're the place to start because the people who are getting coverage from through the exchanges are being hit with these price increases, particularly those who don't get the subsidies through the law. And it's not just that the prices are going up by double digits, it's that the insurers are all but threatening to pull out, in some cases actually pulling out of the exchanges, saying, we will not participate in this program. You have basically all of the major insurers have either pulled out or indicated that that they may scale back their participation significantly in the next year. And in places like Tennessee, that was related to the price increases, where you had insurers renegotiating their already large price increases, premium increases in the exchanges, basically because the state insurance commissioner felt like everyone would bolt from the exchanges. All of the insurers would stop participating in the market
if
they were not allowed to raise their rates, in some cases, by close to 60%.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're talking about something where, you know, somebody, I mean, a lot of those increases, at least in the near term or this year or maybe next year, will be covered by subsidy increases. But, you know, what we're talking about, instead of paying $200 or $400 a month for insurance, you might be paying $500 or $550. And that, you know, that's a sign that the insurers are what? Is it that too many sick people signed up and not enough healthy people? What is driving the price increase? Did the insurers come in too low in order to kind of be good corporate citizens? You know, what goes into that, you know, significant price increase in a lot of different parts of the country?
The biggest factor is that is sort of twofold, which is that there weren't enough people that signed up, and the people who did were sicker than expected. And so if you look at CBO's initial projections for the law, it was more than 20 million people would have insurance through the exchanges at this point. And instead, it's more like 10 to 12 million. Hmm. And so
and how
we're
much
way
of that
under.
Can I ask how much of that, because of course there is the individual mandate, which was the cornerstone of a lot of libertarian opposition and I think some conservative opposition to the law, the idea that the federal government had the authority to force people into economic activity that they would otherwise eschew, you know, that passed muster with the Supreme Court. But is the lower than expected enrollment numbers, is that because Medicaid expansion was not greenlit?
So we're just talking about the exchanges here.
Right.
And Medicaid's a separate thing.
Okay.
Lower than expected numbers, the primary factor, or the biggest factor, I should say, it comes from the fact that CBO expected more employers to dump their employees mm-hmm. into the exchanges, and that just didn't happen at the level that CBO predicted.
Okay, so in a way, that disproves one of the large, you know, kind of fears or negatives that I think Reason probably trafficked in, as well as many critics or even, you know, just down the line analysts.
It was a possibility.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The Congressional Budget Office, you know, the folks who are not striding critics of the law in any way, that it was what they were seeing to. Employers sort of had done what was predicted, as is often the case. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. if you go back to a lot of the law, both the critics and the opponents turned out to be wrong in a lot of ways. And
yeah.
that is one of the most consistent features that
so
we
that means
see sort of the analysis of.
Right. So for the Obamacare exchanges, and this is when you go to healthcare.gov and you sign up and, you know, you pump in your data and then you get a rate plus a potential subsidy figure, depending on what plan you you pick up. The enrollment there is about half or so of what was expected. And the people who have signed up are sicker than the CBO or than the analyst projected. So that's a major part of
that. That is what the insurers are saying. And there's also some effect. Some of the effect is that insurers, it seems pretty likely, insurers priced low up front in order to gain market share, hoping that people would sort of would get on their plan up front and then stick with them. So that's one part of the story, I think, as well. And, you know, but the basic story here is that insurers aren't making money in the exchanges. A very small number of them, typically insurance companies that have experience handling Medicaid caseloads through privatized Medicaid programs or sort of semi-privatized Medicaid programs, they seem to be doing the best at providing kind of lower end coverage for a sicker population. But the big insurers in particular, and also the nonprofit co-ops that were set up under Obamacare using government loans. Most of the co-ops have failed. A few more are look likely to fail, even if Obamacare sort of stays alive. And the big insurers have basically all scaled back or threatened to scale back their participation in the exchanges.
And that
because it's just very hard for them to make money. And they were promised a big group of people who would come in and buy their product, and they thought that there was money to be made in this. And it turns out that it's a lot harder than a lot of people thought.
Yeah, and I mean, it's worth going back to the legislative history and of how hard Obama worked and the Democrats worked and were successful with only Democratic votes. And we'll talk a little bit about partisanship and how that plays out in legislation later. But the idea was that the insurers would get a bite at a whole new market that otherwise would go without insurance. And they'd be able to price things properly and then make money, because even if the individuals covered weren't paying the full price, the American taxpayer, the U.S. government, would be covering that up or covering that with a subsidy. What about how big a deal for – so on the exchanges, Obamacare is floundering. It's having trouble covering its costs. Its costs are coming in higher than expected. Do people like the coverage that they're getting through that? Do you know, are there surveys of whether or not people who get insurance through an Obamacare exchange, do they like it, or are they kind of pissed? Because one of the backdrop conversations of American health insurance lately is the shift, which is still a minority of people, but people moving to high deductible lower premium plans, and people kind of get pissed when they realize that they're out of pocket, three grand for an individual, $6,000 for a family, something like that.
So in general, as a guideline, people like being covered more than they like not being covered. But you do see an awful lot of complaints about the plans being sold on the health insurance exchanges set up under Obamacare, and in particular for the deductibles. Mm-hmm. And these, a lot of these plans have quite high deductibles. And there's not anything, I think, wrong in theory with high deductible plans. And in fact, libertarian, conservative, sort of more market-oriented folks have talked up the virtues right. of high deductible plans for years. But the whole thing about high deductible plans is that they're supposed to be inexpensive, and then they cover you on the back end if things ever get really bad, if there's very high expenses that you're faced. And so they're there in an emergency when you need it.
Yeah,
and what you've got with Obamacare are very expensive plans that also have high deductibles. And that's not a good combination, and people aren't gonna gravitate towards that.
Yeah. So then let's talk about the Medicaid issues or the issues with Medicaid. The way that Obamacare was originally written, it would be the states would be forced, if they were going to take any Medicaid money, they would have to cover a larger number of people than were currently covered under Medicaid, which is the government federal. It's paid for by states and by the federal government. To pay for poor people who can't, or people who can't afford insurance on their own. The Supreme Court said yes to the individual mandate. They said no to the automatic or for mandatory Medicaid expansion. How many states are now have expanded Medicaid, and how is that working out for them as a whole?
More than half of states have expanded Medicaid. But one of the things that's kind of interesting that we've seen is some evidence come up in the last month or so that a lot of the folks who are getting Medicaid through Obamacare, getting covered through Obamacare's Medicaid expansion, were people who would have been eligible previously. And so this was something that got talked about a little bit in the sort of lead into Obamacare, was that the Medicaid expansion would have what was called a woodwork effect in terms of bringing people who were already eligible under previous state and federal guidelines to get covered. And it looks like a lot more people than we thought are basically woodworkers, people who would have been covered, or people who could have been covered previously. And so the other thing that's happening with Medicaid enrollees under Obamacare is that individually they're turning out to be a lot more expensive than expected. This is something that Brian Blais at the Mercatus Center has, mm-hmm. has really pointed out, is that these on an individual basis, those costs have come in much higher than expected.
Yeah, you write actually that an August report from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services found that the cost of the Medicaid expansion was about 50% higher than expected on a per capita basis, coming in at just over $6,300 per person. So now the federal government is paying the full cost of the Medicaid expansion up front for a couple of more years, and then 90% after that. What is the overall effect on the kind of financial sustainability or projections for the Affordable Care Act?
I mean, what it means is that this part of it came in more expensive on a per person basis. And you have to sort of understand that in the context of how Medicaid works with state budgets. Mm-hmm. The whole reason that the Supreme Court said that that Medicaid could not be effectively mandatory, the Medicaid expansion could not be effectively mandatory for states, was that Medicaid is such a significant portion right. of state budgets, because the way it works is that there's a matching. It's a system of matching grants where if a state expands, then the federal government gives them more money too.
Right.
And so what we've ended up with are state budgets that are just dominated by Medicaid spending. And if the federal government were to revoke its portion of Medicaid for any state, in many cases yeah. you'd be cutting state budgets so dramatically and so hugely that like states basically couldn't survive yeah. that. And so
in every state
ruling was that this counted as a gun to the head of the states.
Right.
And that the federal government cannot compel them to make this kind of choice, which yeah. is effectively what they would be doing.
Right. And in every state in the country, Medicaid costs are either the first or second largest single budget item. Education and Medicaid are always one and two. And depending on the state, one might be the first and the other one the second.
The federal government often uses inducements, but the Supreme Court's argument right. was that this inducement goes further than kind of being a carrot or a small stick. It is, like they said, a gun to the head. We're threatening to completely decimate your
and budget. That is only for the Medicaid expansion, not the core Medicaid program. And the Medicaid expansion essentially increased the population that was available or was eligible for Medicaid to include single people who were making a certain amount of money. I mean, they weren't making no money, but they weren't making too much money, and normally they hadn't been covered by Medicaid, correct?
The Medicaid program is technically voluntary for every state everywhere and always has been. And what the ruling said was that you cannot tell states, you will either participate in this additional expansion or we will mm-hmm. revoke all previous federal Medicaid funding from you. And so that would have been an effectively mandatory participation mm-hmm. from the states. But it's also the sort of thing where they didn't even think that there would be an issue because the designers of the program just assumed that states participate in Medicaid.
Right.
They will want lots of free money from the federal government. The expansion is 100% paid for up front, and then in later years, it's 90% paid for. There was no real thinking that there would even be any resistance.
Right.
And so that was part of the kind of crafting process as well.
Well, what are the effects, before we turn to some of that, and also the Republican, if not quite embrace, I mean, at least an air kiss to Obamacare, as they get closer and closer to being on the hook for it, or for its repeal in any case. But are there other effects of Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act on people who don't get their health care, you know, through Medicaid or through the exchanges? Peter, as an employee at Reason, and I don't even know, and I don't want to know if you're on Reason's insurance plan, but we recently switched providers, and it was because our previous provider had presented us with a new contract that would have massively increased our premiums. Is there anything that can be said reliably and responsibly about whether or not Obamacare is jacking up healthcare premiums across the board, or what is the effect on employer-based healthcare, if any?
So healthcare premium increases and healthcare cost increases are a fact of life with or without Obamacare. And we have seen sort of the share of the national economy devoted to health spending just rise and rise over the past 50 years or so. Really, if you want to sort of take a starting point since around the introduction of Medicare, whether or not there is a correlation or a causal factor there, I think you can speculate. But since around that time, healthcare costs would be going up without Obamacare. I think what's sort of most important to sort of understand here is that it's really hard to disentangle the effect of Obamacare at all. And so you have people who say that Obamacare has brought down healthcare costs, which is not the same as premiums,
mm-hmm.
but sort of the prices of healthcare services.
And does that also mean the cost of bad health to the economy, so that people are getting better? Or, you know, the argument would go that people are getting preventive care, so it may cost more money, but on a per process or per procedure basis, or in the long run, that person stays in the workforce and is productive and gets less health care over time.
So we're probably too early to be sort of thinking about Obamacare's effects mm-hmm. on from preventive care and in general preventive care. The studies suggest that mass preventive care programs cost more than they save,
right?
Because you just end up doing preventive stuff on everyone rather than targeting it to the people who will eventually be effective on. The thing though. To understand is that it's hard to tease out the specific effect of Obamacare on a lot of this mm-hmm. stuff, and whether that's true
people,
in a way that favors the law as well as opposed for people who are in favor of it as well as for critics,
right? Because this is somebody people would say that when premiums always go up, which is interesting because we don't necessarily. We're not necessarily happy, or we don't always expect things in our lives for the price and to go up while the quality either stays the same or degrades over time. Quite the opposite, but people were saying when the rate of premium increase went up at a slower rate, people would say, "Oh, that's Obamacare." But there's evidence to show that the decrease in the rate of increase had started before Obamacare passed. So
that's right.
You can work it in all sorts of, yeah.
The second order effect was apparent before Obamacare passed. And we also had a recession. And mm-hmm. the administration likes to talk about how Obamacare has slowed the rate of healthcare cost inflation. Maybe it had. Maybe it has. It's definitely possible that it has had some effect, but it all seems at virtually certain at the same time that the recession has also had an effect.
Right.
And that, again, trying to sort of separate these things out at the macro level is just very difficult. And remember that Obamacare, this is a mistake that a lot of Republicans make, Obamacare is not the only major health policy in America. There's Medicare and there's mm-hmm. Medicaid and there's a bunch of other stuff going on as well. And Medicare is just a huge, huge player. And in terms of spending, in terms of the way it sets all of these, you know, its pricing system that really kind of directs how care is provided and how care is paid for and sets the tone, sort of sets the standard in a lot of ways for how insurers operate and how they think and how hospitals operate and how they think.
And Medicare
and so
is...
trying to pull Obamacare and just sort of pin everything on Obamacare is a mistake. But there are an awful lot of other interventions into the healthcare market. And the market itself, even beyond the interventions, is extremely complex.
Before we get to what the Republicans are likely to do or what you think the Republicans are likely to do, let me ask you two quick questions that are related to the topic, but not specifically on the kind of politics of the legislation. But, you know, the first is, What is the connection, if any, you know, that we can say with certitude between having health insurance coverage and better health? Because a lot of this conversation, and when you parse the words closely of most of the higher up, the defender of Obamacare, they'll always say we now, you know, more people now have health insurance than ever before. They don't say people have health. Is there a basic connection that we can draw between having health insurance and being healthier? Because we're
it's
also
hard to make that connection.
Okay, because I was going to say we're also in a world now where certain subsets of Americans for the first time in decades are seeing a declining life expectancy. So what do we know about that? You know, what is the connection between having health insurance and being healthy?
The best recent study was a study done out of Oregon, which was a randomly assigned people to get Medicaid. And the random assignment allowed you to tease out some actual causal effects. And so it was a 2-year study and the population that got Medicaid versus the population that didn't showed no measurable health, physical health effects on average. There was no physical health difference. What you did see was that the people who got Medicaid versus the people who didn't, the Medicaid beneficiaries had fewer incidences of health-related financial shock.
Right. It
turns out Medicaid turns out to be a pretty good financial shock absorber.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had what I think is best described as a psychic benefit. They reported that they felt better. Again, there was no, when you actually did tests on them sort of to check their physical health, there was no evidence that they were healthier as a population. Now, people will say, well, the study only lasted a couple of years. Maybe there would have been a bigger effect 5 or 10 years out. It's possible, but we didn't get 5 or 10 years of study.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to do randomized controlled trials in healthcare. The RAND health experiment from a couple of decades back found something similar. And every time you do these large randomized health experiments, which again, they don't get done very often, but you tend to find it's difficult to pinpoint real health effects.
Which
you
is
also see
pretty
some
stunning. You know,
introduction of Medicare. There's a really good study out of MIT from a few years ago that basically says that there was no measurable increase in the health of seniors in the 10 years following the introduction of Medicare. And so we just don't see a huge body of evidence. There are some studies, in particular one that was done a few years ago that tried to match up counties. And so you create basically one county, sort of counties with the Massachusetts health reform. And they found some effect. But the better studies, the randomized control trials in particular, you're not seeing a physical health effect. You're seeing a mental effect because people feel more confident.
Right.
And you're
because
seeing,
you're not
seeing a financial effect.
Yeah. And you're not worried either. You're not nervous that, you know, some kind of, you're going to get pneumonia or you're going to have a heart attack. And not only will you be sick, but you'll be broke as well, which is worth thinking about. But that also kind of, is an argument.
Well, and this is the case again for high deductible,
I was just
kind of
catastrophic
say, health insurance.
Right.
The biggest thing that health insurance, we know it's actually quite good as a financial shock absorber, making sure that people are not exposed to huge financial risk.
But
and
that's
so
also
this is why,
that is a
why we should.
Yeah.
I think that we should be designing healthcare plans and systems that focus on making health insurance do what it is good at doing. And
yeah,
one of the things that Obamacare does is it forces health insurance providers to offer this set of defined benefits that are sort of low level in a lot of cases. Sort of, you get free, stuff at you.
Yeah.
You get annual
checkups for free. You get certain types of remedial care for free. This test, that test, et cetera. So you load up with a lot of stuff. Yeah, that may or may not help.
That's all the preventive stuff that we have pretty good reason to believe costs more than it's worth to provide. And that's all the stuff that we don't have a lot of evidence for believing that it really makes a significant impact on average health of a population.
Yeah,
of course, you will find anecdotes of people whose lives were saved by some of this stuff. But we're looking at, when we're talking about sort of the mass system, we need to be looking at the average effects. And health insurance, like I said, it's good at saving people from big financial shocks. And so that is what policymakers need to understand, is that it's not health care, it's insurance.
Right.
And we should, I am of the opinion that we should think about it more as insurance and as a sort of pocketbook and bank account protector rather than as health care itself, which is a totally separate thing. But of course, it becomes highly entangled with insurance when insurance pays for everything and sort of sets the and directs providers through the payment system.
And there are very few heroes here because, of course, insurance companies work within a massively regulated system, which they, in many cases, benefit massively from. And so they're working every possible angle. This is, there are maybe no heroes here, only villains, or we're in a kind of Westworld where nobody is pure, it seems. But let me ask you other question.
There's certainly no heroes, but I'm not sure it's all villains either. Mm-hmm. It's more sort of no real good guys and a lot of people who are sort of trying to be.
Right. Or, well, I mean, let's put it this way, that when you're talking about having insurance actually be that kind of financial backstop or the bank account protector, it means one thing. When you are forcing people who give any insurance to provide all sorts of services, particularly of things like regular blood tests or, blood work, even annual exams or random checkups or urgent care if you have a cold or the flu or something. These are things where you would expect markets to develop very cheap and very effective screening mechanisms and interventions. In the same way that there are tens of thousands of quick lube joints for oil changes because it's an easy kind of mass producible intervention into your car, and it brings down the price. It increases the productivity of everybody involved. But let's talk a bit, and then I want to go to what's going to happen when Donald Trump gets sworn in as president on January 20th. Do you think one of the things that it seems so long ago, even though it's only a few years, but Obamacare was designed exclusively and it was voted on exclusively by Democrats. It passed without a single Republican vote. They had to go back, and you talk about this in your great article, Democrats Defect from Obamacare, which is up at Reason.com, and it's in the most recent issue of Reason magazine. They had to go back to Democrats to give them sweeteners to get them to sign onto the bill, et cetera. Part of that is the Republicans announced staunch opposition and they remained unified in their opposition. And that presents a problem. The fact that it was passed only with Democratic votes, it's probably the single largest type of piece of legislation that was completely voted through by a single party. Apart from whether or not the Republicans are, recalcitrant blockheads or the Democrats are egomaniacal, totalitarians, do you think this says anything about the need for, if not compromise, but some form of bipartisanship and cross-party support for this kind of, what Obama would call transformational legislation?
So one of the big issues with Obamacare is that almost entirely independent of the policy, though not quite. It has been just a political mess that of the sort that the people backing it, at least, did not expect. And if you go back and look at the 2010 midterm election, there's some pretty good evidence that Democrats lost control of the House simply by virtue of their support for Obamacare.
You talk about it in your story that it's rare when Obamacare has ever polled over 50% approval. People, for whatever reason, large numbers of people don't really kind of cotton to the idea of a nationalized health insurance plan.
And so this has made it extremely politically unstable because Democrats went ahead and passed this entirely on their own. What you ended up with is a law that never became really popular in the way that, say, Medicare is, and that has a political party where maybe their number one goal for the last 6 years or so has been to repeal this thing. And that has basically meant that unless it is wildly successful as policy and just sort of works without any kind of additional grease, that it's the politics simply make the law unstable. And so this is just generally a lesson for kind of passing big ticket reform legislations of any kind, which is that without some sort of bipartisan cover, whether from the public or whether from sort of your the opposing party in Congress, these big ticket reforms just become unstable because inevitably they don't work out perfectly and they need to be kind of propped up through the political system. We've certainly seen that with Obamacare, where the administration is making a series of kind of dubiously legal payments to insurers in order to keep the system going, in order to keep insurers from dropping out of the exchanges even further and from raising prices even further.
Two questions real quickly, and then we'll wrap up. First, what is the legal issue over government payments to insurers? Is it that technically the law does not actually authorize the government to pay insurance subsidies, or what is that?
So there's a couple of different issues, but the basic thing is, does the federal government actually have the authority to make these payments to insurers? And there's sort of provisions for these payments built into the law, but there's not funds. And so the administration is just kind of making up funds and tapping money that it's not really clear that they have the authority to tap in order to make these payments. And so at least one judge has already ruled that the federal government does not have the authority to make these payments. There's a pretty good case to be made, I think, that they have overstepped their bounds. And so this just sort of shows you the kinds of political grease, the sort of actions that are necessary in order to keep a law like this afloat, where the policy was already kind of janky to begin with, and then as it starts to break down, the administration has to take actions that are, at minimum, kind of just dubious, right? It's sort of like, is this really? This is stretching the limits of executive authority at minimum. And that is much harder in a political environment where one party is really deeply opposed to the law and isn't going to give you cover.
Well, let's talk about the Republicans now. In your article, Democrats Defect from Obamacare, you talk about how they, particularly in the subtitle and in the text of the story, how Republicans are starting to hedge on their promises to repeal and replace. And you cite them saying things like, well, you know what, we're not going to get rid of all of the law because things like letting kids stay on their parents' insurance plans until they're 26 or whatever, you know, that's okay, or this or that provision. You cite Lamar Alexander, the Republican senator from Tennessee, who's the chair of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, is saying that, you know, coming up with a detailed alternative plan would take around 6 years. I mean, the Republicans have had literally forever to put up an alternative for, or I guess figuratively forever, to put up a serious alternative to Obamacare. They could have reformed health care if they felt it needed reforming at all. Back when they ran the Congress and the White House in the early part of the 21st century. Now they're saying, oh, it might be 6 years, it might be longer. What is going on there? And are the Republicans going to come around to a kind of half embrace of Obamacare so as not to rock the boat too much? Are they going to punt completely? Talk a little bit about how they're talking and what you think is likely to play out politically in the early term of Trump's administration, because this is a signature legislative accomplishment for Obama. It was one of the big things that probably sunk Hillary Clinton in the final analysis. And certainly the Republican Party has staked whatever small credibility it has left on repealing and replacing Obamacare.
Well, Republicans have been promising to repeal Obamacare maybe even since before it actually passed. And now they actually have the opportunity to take some real steps because they have the presidency and a majority in both houses of Congress. The problem is they have, you know, the repeal and replace part of the replace part of repeal and replace is not something that they've ever really spent time on. Now, there are plans that are out there. Some of them are in white paper form. Some of them have actually been turned into legislative language. But there's no unity and there's no agreement amongst Republicans on what they should do to replace Obamacare. And there's been no attempt to kind of reckon with what that would mean in terms of policy and in terms of politics. Would all of the people, for example, who are covered now, what would happen to them? Would they be given just a transition period? There's already been some suggestion that maybe every one of them should be grandfathered into whatever this new plan is. And Republicans, as a guideline, this is not true of all of them, but as a guideline, just have not really spent much time thinking about the details of health policy. They have spent a lot of time thinking about the politics of opposing Obamacare. And that was easy when they didn't really have the votes to pass a repeal and replacement plan. And so they could take these fake kind of symbolic test votes where Republicans would vote to repeal Obamacare and then it would die in the Senate and it wouldn't go anywhere. And even if it went somewhere in the Senate, there was always Obama in the White House to veto it. So there was just no threat of it actually being meaningful and taking any kind of and becoming law. And now they're in the position where they actually have to make good on these promises. And it turns out that is a lot more difficult than they thought. And I'll just give you an example is that, part of it is Donald Trump himself, who does not seem to have any kind of priors when it comes to healthcare, doesn't seem to understand how any of it works. The only idea he could ever talk about while he was on the campaign trail was getting rid of lines around the states, which is a really awkward way of referring to getting rid of the allowing people to purchase insurance across state lines. But even the way he wrote up his plan on his website to allow people to buy insurance across state lines would have kept the regulatory environment in each state, which basically negates the whole kind of point of allowing people to buy across state lines. And so Trump doesn't understand this stuff and he doesn't really care. And even this morning, he's tweeting out that Republicans must be careful in that the Dems own the failed Obamacare disaster with its poor coverage and massive premium increases. This sounds like Donald Trump kind of seeing that there is that the politics of repeal are not as obvious once you actually have power than they are when you're just sort of campaigning on a lark. And I think that Republicans are going to run into this kind of not really knowing what they've gotten themselves into and aren't going to know what to do. And that's why we've heard so much talk about, for example, about repeal and delay, which would repeal the law, but then 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road would leave it in place for 2 or 3 or 4 years.
Well, this
replace plan was worked out. But that is just an admission that there is no replacement in the waiting, in the wings, and that they have no additional plan beyond let's repeal it and figure it out. And you run the risk of just kind of repeal and delay becoming a perpetual thing like the doc fix was for almost
Medicare,
two decades,
yeah.
Where you know you get to the end of you get to if it's a 2 year delay, you get to the end of 2 years, there's no replacement in the works. And so they just delay it another year or another 2 years. And the whole thing just sort of kind of lives on, even though it has theoretically been repealed and Republicans can claim victory that way.
So
if they don't have another system, if they don't have something that they want to do, then they're going to have a very hard time.
Let me ask you then, because there are two related questions. One, the Republicans argued, and I think rightly, that the individual mandate was an assault on basic constitutional liberties. You know, that it went straight to the heart of the American experiment, that the idea that the government, it's one thing that, you know, the Constitution obviously gives Congress or the federal government the ability to regulate commerce among the states, but, you know, that this was a massive shift in the power of the government. Are they even talking about repealing the individual mandate? And then also, does this speak to a lot of critics of the Republican Party during the Obamacare kind of discussions just said, you know what, these guys, they're not serious about governing, that they fundamentally, they can say no, but they're doing this not because of any kind of real ideological or philosophical position, but rather just to kind of be dicks when it comes to screwing over the president, who Mitch McConnell, soon after Obama was elected, said our number one priority was to make him a one-termer. Is this revealing? Is the shoddy and half-assed Republican response to Obamacare? Is it just revealing the critics to be right, that the Republicans are fundamentally kind of clowns when it comes to actually putting forth not a replacement for Obamacare, but then saying, you know what, it's not the role of the government. Go screw yourselves. We're getting rid of it all, if they're just kind of screwing around with repeal and delay, repeal and delay.
On the question of the individual mandate, virtually it is likely that if there is a repeal, the individual mandate will be part of that, because the individual mandate is not has been reinterpreted by the Supreme Court, not as a mandate to buy purchase, to buy health insurance, but as a tax penalty if you don't. And so because it is a tax penalty, that means that it is directly budgetary, relevant to the budget, and can be repealed clearly through the reconciliation process. We can talk a little bit more about the reconciliation process if you'd like to. On the question of whether Republicans are interested in governance, I would say that, you know, it varies by the politician. But sort of one thing to think about here, and one thing to remember, is that Republicans' chief criticism of Obamacare for a long time in 2012 and during the 2012 presidential race has been that it cuts Medicare and that it is bad for Medicare beneficiaries. Republicans are not against government health care. And
right.
Medicare is the nation's single-payer system. Republicans are against Democratic health care. And it seems pretty consistent that when Democrats put health care reforms in place, Republicans are against them, whether they're a good idea or a bad idea. And that when programs like Medicare, which help seniors and help a lot of Republican voters, those programs tend to be much more defended and they
even
tend to be
even as they are rife with
close to the hearts of Republican
voters. Yeah, even as they Medicare is the single largest factor in ballooning budget deficits. It's got its own problems. It's got massive amounts of waste, fraud, and abuse. Structurally, it is the worst kind of thing where the beneficiary, the person over 65. Pays very little for what they're getting out of a system. So there's a lot there to kind of chew into. Peter, we will leave it here, though, for now. We have been talking with Peter Suderman. He's the features editor at Reason, and he is also one of the country's best analysts of Obamacare, of the Affordable Care Act. He's got a fantastic story that is burning up the charts at Reason.com called Democrats Defect from Obamacare. Meanwhile, the GOP learns to stop worrying and love Obama's signature legislative victory. Peter, I want to thank you for for joining us. Is there, you know, over under, is Obamacare going to be the dominant topic of conversation for the first week or two of Trump's actual presidency come the end of January?
I think Obamacare is going to remain a topic of conversation for many, many months, if not many years, and that even if we end up with a repeal of some sort here in the near future, which I think is much less likely than a lot of people seem to think, and than Republicans are saying, that Obamacare will be with us in some form or spirits, will linger on for many, many years to come in American politics.
That is about the most depressing thing that I've heard all day, and I hope nothing tops it, but that is a unfortunately, as I was saying, you're one of the sharpest analysts of this, and I suspect that you're absolutely right about that. And we will leave it there with that dark thought. Thanks again, Peter. This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks for joining us. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.